Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Among It's Here and Now, President Bush is among the world leaders expressing concern and offering prayers today for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who is fighting for his life in a Jerusalem hospital after undergoing surgery following a massive stroke. The 77-year-old Sharon is said to be in stable condition, on a respirator, and in deep sedation. Vice Premier Ehud Olmert was named acting prime minister and convened the Israeli cabinet for a special session today to discuss this crisis at the height of Sharon's popularity and at a critical time in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas said today that he's following Sharon's illness with great worry, but he says it will not affect the Palestinian election scheduled for later this month. Joining us with the latest from Jerusalem is Ken Ellingwood. He's Jerusalem correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Ken, Sharon suffered what was described as a mild stroke last month that may or may not have been caused by a heart problem that was supposed to be surgically repaired this week. What's the latest on his condition?
Well, the latest on his condition is that he remains in serious and stable condition in the hospital. He is expected to be under heavy sedation for another day, assuming that he survives this. The best medical thinking on this is that his most recent stroke, which was a massive one, may have been complicated or brought on in some part by the use of blood thinners that he began taking after his first stroke last month.
Mm-hmm. There are widespread rumors, aren't there, that Sharon is actually far worse off than officials have been letting on. Have they been asked about that?
Yeah, they have. In fact, one of the top officials at Hadassah Hospital, where the Prime Minister is staying, came out specifically to address reporters this afternoon to allay fears that Sharon had in fact died. There were rumors that were beginning to circulate around the country that he had died, and they reached such a level that the hospital felt it necessary to come out and say no, that wasn't true.
How are Israelis reacting?
With great concern. Sharon is a very pivotal figure here. He has been one of the constants, it seems, almost on the political scene, almost since or military scene, almost since Israel's creation. And you know, you read a lot of the commentary here in the newspapers, and people refer to Sharon as a kind of national father figure in a way. People depend on Sharon, whether they like him or they don't like him. He has been charged with keeping Israel safe, and whether one disagrees or agrees with his methods over the years, he has made it clear that is his top mission. And so there is this sense of a family elder in a way, on a possible a deathbed situation.
This is a very serious health crisis, as you say. There was a special session of cabinet today, and Vice Premier Olmert has been named acting prime minister. How are Israeli officials preparing for the possibility that the very likelihood, really, that he will not return to power, that Sharon will not return? And what's the process for a transfer of power? Just briefly, please, Ken.
Well, the process has essentially been completed in the near term, at least. Olmert has taken over as the acting prime minister. He will have limited powers to conduct business with that duty. But elections are scheduled in late March. They were already, and that timetable remains in place. That is, there will be a new prime minister chosen in March.
Okay. Ken, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Ken Ellingwood is Jerusalem correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We want to take a few minutes now to look at how the possible loss of Ariel Sharon could affect Israeli politics and the Mideast peace process. Mr. Sharon is known for being a hawk, but last year he orchestrated the withdrawal of Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip and parts of the West Bank, and that move caused widespread divisions within his Likud party. In November, Sharon broke from that party and formed the new Kadima party. He also called for new parliamentary elections in March, in which his Kadima party was expect it to dominate. So what happens now? Well, joining us on the line from Washington to answer that and other questions is Ambassador Ned Walker. He's President and Chief Executive Officer of the Middle East Institute and the U.S. Ambassador to both Israel and Egypt during the Clinton administration. And I want to start by asking you, Ambassador, does the possible loss of Mr. Sharon mean turmoil for Israeli politics?
I don't think so. I've seen that in a lot of the commentary and so on. The Israelis have an uncanny ability to carry on, and they have done so before. When prime ministers have died in office, they will do so today. I don't expect anybody to take dynamic moves in the next 100 days while Ehud Olmert is the acting prime minister. Everybody's going to be keying up for the election that's coming, and nobody's going to want to look like they're stepping on Sharon's legacy. It will have some internal maneuvering going on among the parties, but, you know, that was going to take place anyway. After all, the Kadima list that Sharon headed hadn't even chosen its list of candidates or the order of them, so that all still has to be done.
But wasn't Sharon basically the Kadima party?
I mean, he is, except that he brought with him some of the strongest people in Likud. They continue on, and I think it's unlikely that they'll want to go back to Likud so long as it's headed by Bibi Netanyahu. That break, I think, was pretty significant and unrepairable.
Let's talk about Mr. Netanyahu for a moment here. If Mr. Sharon was seen as the person who would keep security in Israel and really fight to sort of make sure that security was under control in Israel, is Mr. Netanyahu second in line for that?
Well, he's got some problems. He would be, except that he has defined himself now as to be the leader of the far right, and particularly of the settler movement, and opposed to any further withdrawals, or opposed really to the withdrawal that already took place. Former Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to have a problem trying to attract from the center of the political spectrum, and elections in Israel tend to be won by those who can attract the center.
Is it likely that the March elections in Israel will be delayed because of this?
No, I think it's unlikely, and the president's made it clear they won't be delayed. I think that the political apparatus and the country needs to have a firm decision about leadership.
Mr. Sharon's illness comes at an extremely tenuous time in Israeli-Palestinian relations, and at a time when Palestinians are still recovering from the loss of their leader, Yasser Arafat, who died about 14 months ago. So what do the Palestinians need to do to help ensure peace?
Well, the Palestinians still haven't sorted themselves out after Arafat's death. There is no central figure that can pull all the factions together the way Arafat used to do. They haven't sorted out who's going to direct the Palestinian people and what is the vision of Palestine for the future, and what is the attitude going to be towards violence as a mechanism of the policy and so on. And then they have the problem, which is that's just within the Fatah movement and the PLO. They then have the problem of how do you integrate the Hamas people and those who believe that the answer to occupation is terrorism and violence. They've got a long way to go before they become a coherent entity that can engage in meaningful negotiations. It's impossible for the Israelis to negotiate with Palestinians until they can come together.
What about the Palestinian election scheduled for later this month? Any disruption there at all?
Well, this is where Olmert's going to have a real challenge because it all revolves around Hamas and Abu Mazen, the Palestinian leader, has indicated that if the Jerusalem Arabs can't vote, then he won't want to go forward with the election. Olmert, as the former mayor of Jerusalem for many years, is going to be challenged as to the decision he makes regarding the voting of Arabs in Jerusalem.
And how are Palestinians reacting to what's happened to Mr. Sharon?
I think most Palestinians, although many Arabs couldn't abide Sharon because of his past, many of them had grudging respect for him because of his most recent activity, pulling out of the Gaza Strip and so on. So I think they're going to find that they miss Arik Sharon.
So what would you say needs to happen in terms of leadership on the Israeli side to really keep the peace and keep security under control?
I think that what the acting prime minister is going to have to do is to find a way to allow the Jerusalem Arab voters to vote in a way that doesn't challenge his long-term position, long-time position as Jerusalem as the unified capital of Israel. But it's been done before, and during his tenure as the mayor of Jerusalem, he did find ways of accommodating the Palestinians when it was necessary. So I expect that that's what he'll do. He'll find a way to allow this election to go on and won't give Abu Mazen the excuse of Jerusalem to break down the election.
Did you know Sharon?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've known him for a long time. Back in the 80s we first met. He was an extremely warm and engaging person on a one-to-one basis. I mean, he used to go out to his ranch, and it was a pleasure to deal with him. He had a great love of music. He had a broad sense of the world. He was a man that was fun to spend time with. I don't always, certainly didn't always agree with his political choices or his moves, but I had a great deal of respect for him.
Because you knew Ariel Sharon, I'm wondering, what do you think that he will probably be most remembered for? I mean, he's obviously, well, a lot of people may think of the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the settler pullout that most recently happened. What's the legacy of Ariel Sharon?
Well, I think the legacy of Sharon was his incredible service to the state over so many years in the military and then in politics. I think that he will be remembered as a great soldier who helped secure the country, and he'll certainly be remembered for leading the way on the Gaza pullout, the first major Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza since the 67 war.
Ambassador Walker, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You bet.
Ambassador Ned Walker is president and chief executive officer of the Middle East Institute. He was the U.S. ambassador to both Israel and Egypt during the Clinton administration. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Just ahead, doctors are urged to consider a treatment that sends cancer drugs directly into the abdomens of women with advanced ovarian cancer. We look at the procedure and wonder, can such a method work with other cancers? And later in the show, in a sea of multiplexes and DVDs sent to your home, we look at an independent movie theater's struggle to survive. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. There's new hope today for women suffering from ovarian cancer. A study published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine says patients with an advanced form of the disease who had chemotherapy drugs injected directly into their abdomens lived on average 16 months longer than those who did not. Researchers say doctors should start offering this new treatment to ovarian cancer patients immediately. We're joined on the line by Dr. Stephen Canestra, an oncologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Doctor, can you explain exactly what happened here? The chemotherapy was injected directly into where the cancer was affecting these patients?
Yes. So ovarian cancer is a disease that tends to spread locally within the abdominal cavity. And the idea is that by administering chemotherapy locally, we can achieve high concentrations of the drug and kill more tumor cells than could be killed if the same chemotherapy was administered by vein.
And has that been the standard treatment for ovarian cancer in the past? Has been this type of intravenous chemotherapy?
That's right. So patients with ovarian cancer tend to present with disease that has escaped beyond the ovary. And it's very difficult for the surgeon to remove all of the disease completely. That is why most patients after the operation will need some form of chemotherapy. The problem is that in many patients, unfortunately, despite initial success and the ability to kill residual cancer, in many patients the tumor still comes back again. And that's why we're looking for better ways to fight this cancer.
Mm. Ovarian cancer is the fourth deadliest cancer. About 16,000 women died from ovarian cancer last year. Why is that?
Well, part of the reason for that relates to the fact that this tumor is very silent for most of its course in patients. So a woman may have a small ovarian tumor that it does not cause symptoms and is so small that it cannot be felt on pelvic exam. But yet, because it is present at the surface of the ovary, is in a prime position to start to shed tumor cells throughout the abdominal cavity in a very silent way, such that approximately 70% of patients with ovarian cancer will unfortunately present to their doctor with signs and symptoms that reflect the presence of tumor that has already spread to the upper abdomen.
So I'm wondering then, is this sort of direct injection into the abdomen really something unique to ovarian cancer because of the way it spreads, and it wouldn't maybe be as effective for, say, lung cancer to have injections directly into that area of the body, or colon cancer? I mean, could this be applied to other forms of cancer as well?
Well, no, you're exactly right. I think ovarian cancer is somewhat unique in the sense that the tumor tends to remain localized within the abdominal cavity for much of its natural history. It causes most of its trouble because we have difficulty eradicating the local tumor within the abdomen. So that is why ovarian cancer is one of those tumors that lends itself to this concept of intraperitoneal chemotherapy.
Isn't it more toxic to inject the chemotherapy directly into someone's abdomen?
Yes. The side effects that are seen with intraperitoneal cisplatin are generally greater than what we see with intravenous administration of drugs like Taxol and carboplatin. They include the potential for catheter infections. Remember that in order to use chemotherapy intraperitoneally, you need a catheter that's inserted directly into the belly. Patients will experience abdominal bloating and discomfort. There is a greater potential for other side effects. But in general, it is a more complicated regimen and associated with greater potential for side effects that impact on the patient's quality of life during administration of the treatment. The intraperitoneal approach was associated with a decrease in quality of life while patients were receiving the treatment and for a short time after the treatment was completed. But thankfully, the quality of life returned back to normal such that when it was checked a year later, it was back to baseline. This is an important point, though, that you raised. Because there is increased side effects, patients will need to be part of the decision-making process, as they always should be. And after being informed of the side effects and the potential benefit that the intraperitoneal approach will yield, they can then weigh in on whether it's the right approach for them.
So the National Cancer Institute issuing a statement encouraging doctors to start using this method of treatment immediately. I'd like to know a couple of things about that. Is it a big deal? And then obviously, even though that recommendation has been issued, folks would still have to evaluate because the side effects may be greater because of this.
Yes, I think that clinical judgment is always involved in these kinds of decisions. I think it's fair to say that the intraperitoneal approach now offers us a very important new option. And so for that subset of patients, intraperitoneal chemotherapy is a reasonable option to discuss and ought to be discussed. However, whether a patient actually does it or not depends on a number of things. She needs to be healthy enough to get through it. And then the patient needs to understand that she is accepting a greater degree of side effects with this approach. That being said, I think in my experience, most patients, for understandable reasons, are willing to accept a greater degree of side effects if, at the end of all of this, their potential for surviving the disease is greater.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked about this particular study, it's 16 months.
Yes. Now, that deserves some clarification. 16 months is the average prolongation of survival. So it's an average figure.
Mm-hmm. So it's significant.
Very significant. And that improvement in survival is related to the fact that there's a decreased risk of relapse with the intraperitoneal approach.
All right. Well, Dr. Canestra, oncologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the latest from the Middle East, plus an artist's view of occupied Iraq. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
It's Here and Now. Ahead of next week's confirmation hearings, supporters and critics of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito are hoping to win over undecided Americans and senators with new ads, such as this one from the liberal group IndependentCourt.org.
Alito promised to disqualify himself from certain cases, but news reports reveal he broke his own commitment three times. Even ruling in favor of a company he invested with, then gave three different excuses why. His actions were called troubling and poor judgment. Shouldn't we be able to trust Supreme Court nominees to keep their word?
On Monday, Alito will likely face tough questioning from the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's expected to be even more contentious than the recent interrogation of Chief Justice John Roberts, and it will include issues such as abortion laws and executive branch powers amid concerns about the president's secret surveillance program. Well, joining us on the line is Jonathan Turley. He's a professor at George Washington University Law School. Welcome back to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you.
A new poll this week from the Wall Street Journal Online says there's little consensus among the public about whether Judge Alito should be confirmed. So how do you think these ads might affect these hearings?
Well, they're all directed at these marginal senators, and specifically the Democratic senators. There's a great irony here that even though the Democrats are in the minority, they could defeat this confirmation with a filibuster. I think it's pretty clear that they could actually hold a filibuster, and they could defeat what's called a nuclear option, an effort by the Republicans to essentially strip the filibuster rule in the Senate. The only question is whether they can show that level of discipline. If they held together all 45 members, they could probably, I think very likely, win a filibuster fight. But, you know, what these groups are trying to do is to get marginal senators, people like Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and others, to really, you know, put a shot across their bow and get voters to contact them.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do you see similarities here with the Robert Bork hearings from the 1980s?
Well, the greatest similarity is this is the largest coalition of opposition groups that we've seen in the city since Bork. It's larger than what we saw with Thomas. You really have opposition from across the board, disability groups, gay rights groups, minority groups, women's groups. It's a pretty formidable number of organizations that are really pulling out the stops in opposition. And once again, they're primarily pounding the doors of Democratic senators to try to get them to hold firm on the nomination and talk filibuster.
Mm-hmm. These new ads portray Alito as a pledge breaker. There are questions about his integrity, and then the other side is obviously touting his integrity. Where's the substance here? What would you say?
Well, the hyperbole has really gotten to reach an unprecedented height. I mean, you've got some ads that actually say that Alito is the defender of Christmas, and another ad refers to him virtually as the Maquis de Sade trying to strip search adolescent girls. And, you know, the funny thing is all of these ads make him more interesting than he really is. I've read all of his opinions, and, you know, I've got pieces coming out in USA Today and Chicago Tribune on those opinions for next week. And, you know, what you come across with Alito is a rather dull judicial technocrat. I mean, he's sort of the Bob Newhart of judging. You know, he gives these sort of deadpan opinions. But beneath those opinions is a rock-hard conservative. I mean, he is very deferential to the government to a point that will raise serious questions. I mean, there's a lot of attention on abortion, and that issue tends to suck the air out of the room. The far more serious issue, I think, in terms of his opinions, is the almost blind deference that he gives the government. I mean, I happen to support a lot of his views, but I, frankly, am a bit taken aback by how deferential he really is to the government.
And how? And what about timing here in terms of that and in his previous writings about the executive branch? Amid this whole controversy about the secret domestic surveillance program, how do you think that's going to play out?
Well, it's bad timing for him because he is a dream of a judge for the president. He, in past cases of government abuse, Alito shows very little concerns about the potential for government abuse or the court's role in checking it. He's ideal for this president. And if he made it on the court, you really could see the Supreme Court tilt heavily in the same direction. So I think he's going to get a lot of questions. Now, what he's going to do, obviously, is refuse to answer them. I mean, mm-hmm. He's going to do a John Roberts. And this is where these Democratic senators are going to pay a cost for the Roberts hearings. You know, John Roberts made one legal conclusion in his hearings, and it happened to be totally wrong. And I supported John Roberts, but he said that judicial ethics prevented him from answering questions on his views. Not a single Democratic senator said, what rule is that? There is no such rule. His colleagues on the Supreme Court routinely discuss their views and publish articles on it. But Senator Leahy voted for him and created precedent of his own that a nominee can refuse to answer these questions and still secure his vote.
So then will they look at his writings in depth then and try to do something else? I mean, what do you predict is going to happen?
Well, I think they're just going to ignore what they did with John Roberts. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time hypocrisy reigned and on Capitol Hill. I mean, Roberts had memos criticizing Roe, and so does Sam Alito. But I think that they're not going to give Sam Alito that extra room. I think this is going to be a bloodletting. And the only question is whether the Democrats can show the discipline, frankly, of Republicans. You know, it's like that wonderful scene in American Tale where the cat tells her boyfriend, I'm just looking for a cat that's more like a dog. And, you know, here I think a lot of Democratic voters are looking for Democrats that are a little more like Republicans and holding a disciplined line. And we'll have to see that. They've got about 40 senators that I think would support a filibuster. There's five out there, with people like Ben Nelson, who could frustrate that effort.
Mm-hmm. You do still think, though, abortion's going to be a significant issue.
Yes, and, you know, Alan Spector is increasingly looking comical. You know, we've had all of these memos come out where Alito is virtually, you know, shredding copies of Roe v. Wade. And Spector comes up with different excuses why he doesn't really mean what he's saying. But at this point, we've got so many memos where this guy is basically saying, I want to put an ice pick in the head of Roe v. Wade, that at some point he looks absurd. And, you know, he is antagonistic towards Roe v. Wade, and he's going to narrow that opinion, if not vote to overturn it. And any suggestion that there's doubt on that point, I think, is really engaging in some pretty odd flights of fancy.
Any predictions about the vote, Jonathan?
You know what? I would not predict the Democrats being disciplined on any issue. They've been sort of a series of independent contractors since this Congress began. But it really depends on the Democratic voters. They can force these senators. And if they do, he'll be defeated.
All right. Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University Law School. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Here and Now. Stay with us. The expected confirmation of Judge Alito and the Supreme Court in general are pretty serious topics, but one man has done a study of how much laughter there is in the nation's highest court. Jay Wexler, an associate professor of law at Boston University, did the study, and he joins us in studio to tell us more about the justice's sense of humor. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me. I'm welcoming you.
You clerked at the High Court, yes?
Yes.
Think most of us would not think it's a very funny place.
I wouldn't say that it's a very funny place either. I worked there from 1998 to 1999, and, you know, the main work of the court is certainly not making jokes, that's
right,
for sure.
Right. But you found that there were instances where the court was funny?
Yes, I did a little study where I examined the transcripts of the oral arguments for an entire term. And I tried to figure out which justice invoked the most laughter from the audience.
Give me an example of something that causes laughter.
Sometimes a person who is making an oral argument will mix up a justice's name. So there have been instances where somebody calls Justice O'Connor Justice Ginsburg or vice versa. And that always causes some uncomfortable laughter. Sometimes it's almost impossible to tell why something gets a laughter notation. For example, Justice Roberts got a laugh for mentioning that the world had changed in the last 60 years such that a case that was decided a long time ago no longer quite applies to our current situation. Almost impossible to figure out why that got a laughter.
So we're not talking comedy club stuff here.
This is not going to put sitcoms out of business by any stretch.
And Justice Scalia was the funniest.
Well, Justice Scalia got the most laughter, and he did so by a wide margin. He had 77 episodes of laughter invoked over the course of the term, and the justice who came in second was Justice Breyer, who was 30 or so laughter episodes behind him. And after that, it fell off precipitously. So Justice Scalia won the most laughter contest. But I think you have to be careful in extrapolating from that in fact, Justice Scalia is the funniest justice, because there are a number of reasons why that link might be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Because?
For one thing, trying counts for a lot at the Supreme Court. So, in other words, Justice Scalia tries to get laughs, and that gets him a long way. By contrast, Justice Thomas, who I had lunch with once and thought he was a very personable and funny guy, gets no laughs, but that could be because he never says anything from the bench, so he doesn't try at all.
Well, and it would seem difficult, too, because it is basically documents here identifying the question and the laughter, and we don't know what kind of laughter and how you define that. So that's a little bit tricky.
That's exactly true. A perfect study would in some way be able to distinguish in intense laughter episodes in terms of intensity and duration. So now, you know, laughing that goes on for 5 minutes and people are, you know, knee slapping and they can't catch their breath, that gets simply a laughter, and so does a chuckle.
You were also trying to put some science into this, and I noticed that you have something called the Justice's Laughter Episodes Instigated Per Argument Average.
That arose because there was a criticism of an early draft of the paper which pointed out that merely showing how many laughter episodes a justice got in a particular term doesn't tell the whole story, because not every justice attends every oral argument. So I did another sort of data, ran the numbers on this, and came up with this average.
And does Scalia still come out on top?
Scalia does still come up on top. In fact, he has more than one laughing episode instigated per argument, which is pretty good. That's one per hour. I don't know how that would compare to, like, Chris Rock, but it's not bad.
And how about Chief Justice Roberts? Any indication at this point what kind of sense of humor we're dealing with here?
Well, there was a lot of talk during his confirmation that he's a funny guy. The early returns that the New York Times did a little extrapolation of the data for the first few terms and came up with Roberts in third place, finishing a strong third so far. And since it's early, he's probably just getting his footing there. I would expect that he will probably make a run for the top, at least the number one or number two spots.
Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jay Wexler is an associate professor of law at Boston University. His article, Laugh Track, appears in the law journal, The Green Bag. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Sluggish movie ticket sales are hurting the multiplexes, but even harder hit are the small art house theaters. Since the 1950s, the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has been a leader in the American art film movement. It's even been credited with transforming Humphrey Bogart into a global icon. Now, the historic theater in the heart of Harvard Square is facing a fiscal crisis and may be forced to go dark. Here and Now's Andrea Shea has more.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Every year, the Brattle Theater splashes Bogie, Bergman, and a cast of characters onto the big screen. For decades, fans of Casablanca have eaten it up. Cindy Heller is one of them. She's been coming here for 20 years.
Everybody in the theater has seen it a million times, too, and they all get involved with the characters, too, and, you know, laugh and cheer at the appropriate times.
Come to my office in the morning. We'll do everything. We'll be there at 6. I'll be there at 10.
But the theater isn't as full in 2005 as it's been in years past. In the 1950s, when the Brattle's founders first screened Casablanca during exam week at Harvard, hundreds of students would pack the theater day and night. They'd watch the 1942 film dozens of times and memorize the clever script, according to Ned Hinkle, the Brattle's current director.
There's even one story that once the projector's sound went off and it was fine because everybody knew the words and they just started saying them along with the characters on screen anyways. So this sort of bogey cult was birthed in part at the Brattle Theater.
And the cult grew, says Hinkle, ultimately saving Bogart from being, as he puts it, just another dead movie star. But today's Harvard students aren't coming to the Brattle. In fact, a lack of overall attendance ignited the theater's current crisis in the first place. Hinkle says the red flags first went up in late 2004 when he and Brattle co-director Ivy Moylan were shocked to see a 30% drop in ticket sales for that year.
We looked at all the events that were going on. I mean, there was the election and the World Series and the Democratic Convention in town, and we feel like there were a lot of major art house releases that pulled audiences away from us. So we looked at that as potentially a blip.
But it wasn't a blip. Ticket sales fell another 10% during the first half of this year. That hurt, especially since 75% of the Brattle's budget is based on its box office. So the Brattle mobilized. In October, the nonprofit theater set a fundraising goal of $400,000 for year's end. The money will pay for $75,000 worth of recent renovations, aggressive grant writing, marketing, and advertising campaigns, and the theater's high rent. Hinkle says he needs to renegotiate the lease and reassess the business model. The theater also has to attract new audiences, young audiences. If they don't come, he says, the theater's vintage rear screen projectors will stop splashing rare creatures such as Greta Garbo and Godzilla on the big screen for good. Like Godzilla defending himself against his nemesis Mothra, the big screen is under attack, according to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr.
One of the reasons is that we can get movies as well, if not better, elsewhere, home.
That's also one of the reasons the Brattle is against the ropes. There was a time when cinephiles went to repertory theaters to see films they couldn't get anywhere else. Now, online rentals, cable TV, and DVD box sets put obscure cult films, classic film noir, and hard-to-find foreign films at their fingertips. Plus, Burr says most Americans now prefer to watch movies at home on their flat-screen TVs or computers.
And now we've got a whole other generation of technology kicking in. You can download a TV show onto an iPod. And you know what? It doesn't look that bad. It's pretty clear.
It's also pretty sad, according to the Brattle's Ned Hinkle. He says people aren't experiencing films the way they were meant to be seen, and they're missing out.
Watching a movie at home on DVD is very much like opening up an art history textbook and looking at a picture of a famous painting, whereas going to see a movie on screen in an audience of strangers is like going to the museum to see the painting in person.
Hinkle says film is an art and it deserves to be treated like one. Preserving that art is part of the Brattle's mission and part of what's at stake right now. Ty Burr agrees but says art doesn't always turn a profit, especially at a small movie house in the era of the multiplex.
It's a one-screen theater. in a world where one-screen theaters are an economic liability. But what makes it special is that you come here to see a film and to share it with an audience. And, you know, 20 years ago, there used to be a lot of places like that.
While Burr describes the Brattle as a church of cinema, it actually looks like a college auditorium, with aisle lights, a raised stage, and theatrical curtains. It's only one of two single-screen theaters left in the Boston area, and one of a few independent repertory cinemas remaining in the country. Burr says the economics of the film business killed most of the others. But some, such as the historic Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, have evolved and survive.
Could I get two for the squid and the whale?
And this is an upstairs theater number two.
The Coolidge Corner Theater now has three screens and mainly shows first-run independent films, artier Hollywood fare, and documentaries. Ticket sales are strong, according to executive director Joe Zina, but times haven't always been this good.
We did have a period of crisis. We had a couple of them, actually.
A big one occurred in 1988 when the landlord put the building up for sale. Zina says the people of Brookline rallied to raise funds and awareness and save the Coolidge from closing. He hopes Cambridge will do the same for the Brattle.
Cambridge is a vital, energetic, intelligent, cultured audience, and, you know, it's a matter of can they step up to the plate of maintaining a cultural icon in their community.
Brattle director Hinkle says he's been meeting with community leaders and Harvard Square business owners to address the theater's dire straits. They can relate, says Hinkle, to the high rents and general corporatization of the area.
Is the Brattle a relic? And if it goes, what do you lose?
Globe critic Ty Burr.
Not just what do we lose from, you know, having shared social entertainment experiences, but what does a town, what does a university, what does any area lose by losing something that raised its sensibility up a little higher?
The Brattle's Ned Hinkle readily admits it's a challenge to walk the line between art and commerce. But he says no matter how bad things get, he and the rest of the Brattle staff will stick to their guns to maintain the theater's repertory-style programming.
We're not going to say, okay, fewer people want to see these kinds of movies that we're playing. We should turn into a mainstream movie theater and start, you know, trying to play Spider-Man 2 or, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or whatever. That is not a solution for us. It is either stay in this space and continue to program movies here or, you know, stop.
But for now, the Brattle is carrying on with benefit screenings, concerts, and a watch-a-thon. The staff is also reaching out to Harvard alumni and the current student body for support. And while many questions remain unanswered, things appear to be looking up for the Brattle. Its board of directors has given Hinkle the go-ahead to program through February, which means Bogey fans won't miss out on the upcoming Valentine's Day screening of Casablanca.
That's Here and Now's Andrea Shea reporting. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next